Congressman Hill, glad to have you. Just a couple of quick points, and then I'll turn it over to our completely fair-minded journalists. One is that on the PBS forum, we were surprised that there was not hardly any reference to what the candidates thought about President Trump, his administration's policies on the pandemic and the economy. And there's no right or wrong answer, but we would like to hear what your views are basically on President Trump's policy and then policies. And then the other thing is, as we always emphasize, we define the greater Delta region as very much including Little Rock, because there are plenty of diverse and economically distressed neighborhoods in Little Rock that are quite similar to the Delta. But anyway, we're very glad to have Congressman Hill, and now I'll turn it over to the journalist moderators.
Congressman Hill, good to talk to you. I'm Michael Heflin from KUAR. As Lee said, let's talk a little bit about President Trump. What are your thoughts on his job performance overall, as well as during this pandemic?
Well, first of all, on job performance, if you look at, our time is limited, and this is kind of off the subject of the focus of this forum. But I'll summarize by saying in foreign policy, the president has reiterated America's effort to lead in national security by reasserting our partnership in NATO, for example, working for peace in the Middle East, by getting us out of the failed Iran nuclear deal and refocusing the area back on our partnership with Israel on bringing peace to the region and holding Assad more accountable, defeating ISIS. In North Asia, the president has been much more committed than President Obama to the Open Seas Initiative in the South China Sea by using the American Navy to support open sea lanes that are supported by Vietnam, Malaysia, Taiwan, Japan, the Philippines, which the Obama administration had turned a blind eye to. And of course, he's tried to do a reset with North Korea and gotten a unanimous vote in the United Nations Security Council for that. So that remains to be seen how that will play out. And finally, on trade, while I haven't agreed with every tactic he's used on trade, for example, I oppose across-the-board steel and aluminum tariffs, the effort to redo the NAFTA into the USMCA, revise the South Korea agreement, which has cut the trade deficit with the U.S. in half, open up new trading agreements with Kenya, with Europe, and with the United Kingdom, all underway are important efforts. So in foreign policy, I think the president's really reasserted American leadership there in a positive way. In domestic policy, I support the cutting of the red tape across the federal regulatory bureaucracy that I think held back the President Obama's recovery from the 08-09 crisis. And I think the reforms that were put in place in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act also spurred economic activity and corrected a wrong on double taxation of American profits, American profits earned abroad. So I think his overall efforts have been good in the past 4 years on those domestic and foreign policy fronts. As to the pandemic, this was a novel coronavirus that swept over the world in an amazingly fast period of time. I wish we'd gotten 60 days notice from the Chinese of the genetic makeup of the disease and that it was as absolute rapidly infectious as it was. We found that out a little late in the process based on the reports we now have from the World Health Organization and from our supporters and analysis around the intelligence community. And so I appreciate the president trying to shut down air travel for returnees from China in that period and also try to reduce travel to Europe when it spread to Europe. Those were important first steps. But the rest of it was just based on the public health advice that was often conflicting. And so I think the president and our governors did the best they could with the information that they had. And I'm so grateful for two steps taken by Congress. One, the overwhelming response by Congress on a bipartisan basis to help families, help small businesses, help our public health officials, help our hospitals, our first responders, our governors with funding and policies and regulatory relief, including the regulatory relief with the $10 billion in CARES for Operation Warp Speed to tackle the therapeutics and ultimately a vaccine. And I appreciate the Federal Reserve's quick efforts back in March 15th, that weekend, to get our economy markets settled, both equity and debt markets, so our cities, our states, and our companies could borrow the money they need to get through this horrible economic impact from the pandemic.
Well,
so in short, I think the president has a lot of positive accomplishments in domestic and foreign policy. And I think in the pandemic, it's been a real struggle after we got the funding to get a strategy functioning in all of our states and something that's been as infectious as it has been.
Congressman, I want to push back on you a little bit on this, and it kind of is the premise of my question here. The U.S. was the last major country in the world to really feel the effects of the pandemic. We knew it was coming for several months, and we had time to prepare. I would argue today the premise of my question is going to be that the country still doesn't have a grip on the pandemic. The president has said things like, if you take the blue states out, we're at a level that I don't think anybody in the world would be at, which if you look at the top 15 states today, they start at North Dakota and work their way all the way down to Indiana. I would argue that most of them are even lean red states. But none of that really helps us to use this blue and red analogy here. I ask you, what do we need to do to get a grip on this? Where other countries have already recovered and moved on, we should be there too. Why aren't we?
Well, I don't think other countries have recovered and moved on. That's not true in China. That's not true in Italy. That's not true in Europe and France, where they have additional infection, or in the United Kingdom, or in Japan last week. The number of cases per 100,000 of this disease is going to be the same ultimately in all the countries. If you look at the infection rates, if you look at between shutting down economies and not shutting down economies, ultimately the infection rate, when you study that, is approximately the same across the world. For example, in New York, I looked at the end of August data. I haven't looked at the newer data, but when I was studying the economic impacts of it, you had roughly 2,000 cases per 100,000 in New York. You had 2,000 cases per 100,000 in California, Texas, and Arkansas. Those were all in common. But the shutting the states down in New York, they ended up ultimately with approximately the same number of cases per 100,000 citizens as a state like Arkansas or Texas that remained partially open during the infection rate. What we have to recognize here, using the federal resources that we have, is we all have to live with the virus, and therefore following the CDC standards is important on social distancing, using a mask, being careful, sheltering those who are more susceptible to the disease by age or comorbidity. This is what we've done traditionally when we faced this kind of thing before. And we have to recognize that the promises made to us by public health officials back in March, oh gosh, if you just shut things down for 15 days and then 30 days, the virus comes in across the whole country equally and then exits the whole country equally. And that's, of course, just not what's happened. It comes in waves and attacks population centers at different times in different ways. And it's a very challenging infectious disease in that regard. So no one here has got a big winning app on this, Roby, in any country of the world, in my view.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I want to make sure, Congressman, we get in all the questions that we also asked Senator Hill, and we will come back to the president in just a bit. But during this pandemic, we've had schools having to shift many to virtual education, and we've learned how many areas of the state, especially rural districts, have not had the broadband infrastructure to adequately handle this. So in terms of infrastructure, first, broadband. Would you support And what could you do if reelected to improve broadband access?
Thanks, Michael. Well, when I'm reelected, we want to continue this conversation on broadband. As I said in the PBS debate, I think this is the rural electrification story that we faced back during the 1930s. This is so important to telemedicine and telehealth. And if we've learned anything through the pandemic, we've learned the importance of connectivity. We've seen it in our business, we've seen it in government, we've seen it internationally. But in delivering telehealth by audio versus video, by trying to deliver education equally across rural and urban areas. And it's not just whether you have it or not, it's can you afford it or not? And is the speed adequate? So there are really three factors in looking at broadband. Access, and Governor Hutchison tells us there are about 200,000 Arkansans that don't have access. Access at a certain price that you can afford. And then access that you can afford that has enough speed to perform whatever functions you need, whether it's video or audio or telehealth or telemedicine. We don't need our kids going through McDonald's drive-through lanes to get the Wi-Fi to do their lessons. So we need our schools open even during the virtual and non-virtual, in other words, in class and virtual. We need them still available on campus for that internet access. We need our public libraries available for that internet access. And we need to expand the broadband reach. So in the CARES Act, there was $100 million. Plus there is grant money for rural states and the Rural Connect. Our electric co-ops got $76 million for expanding broadband in their footprints. And I think the thing I've advocated for since June that's been bottled up in the debates in Congress has been, let's let the states who have $1.25 billion, like Arkansas, the smaller states, use that money past 12/31/2020 and extend it, as Chuck Grassley wants to do, to 90 days after the next fiscal year end for infrastructure investments, particularly broadband. And Governor Hutchison and his chief financial officer, Larry Walther, and the legislature, that's what they'd like to do. I'm fully supportive of that. And that's what I've proposed that we get out of this next coronavirus relief package. Further, I have a bill that I've co-sponsored with Gary Palmer of Alabama that says that if you spend the CARES Act money for broadband, for example, or another infrastructure item, the federal government will match it 50%. So these are things I think we should do to expand broadband reach in Arkansas. And there's a lot of bipartisan support for that.
Yeah, two other aspects, though, in terms of our infrastructure. We've got a crumbling highway system. We've got other aspects in the nation also concerning I guess my question is, you know, what do we do about highways, bridges, other crumbling aspects of our infrastructure?
We have a highway, thanks, Michael. We have a highway authorization bill every 5 years. It's up this year. The Democrats in the House produced a bill that could not get support in the Senate. It was a very partisan bill. So I think in early 2021, we'll see a revised highway infrastructure bill that will provide the federal matching dollars to the states. And of course, Governor Hutchison's out campaigning right now for his proposal that enhances Arkansas's ability to do highway infrastructure that's on the ballot here in 20 days or so. And so there's bipartisan support for that. What's gotten done in the last 3 years on infrastructure, besides the five-year highway bill, is about $100 billion or so extra in build grants for special projects in the states and PPP type projects where you have a public-private partnership. The problem with that, Michael, is it doesn't really adequately help a rural state like Arkansas, because public-private partnerships require density. And so that money almost exclusively goes to urban areas. So we need to make sure that our infrastructure bills support rural states like Arkansas.
Congressman, let's talk about race and police force, which has been a huge topic of discussion this year. It's obviously fits and starts over the decades. We have had this continuing conversation in America about race. 164 Black people have been killed by the police just this year, in the first 8 months of this year. Obviously, we've seen some very high profile killings in that respect. Do you think that there is systemic racism in our police forces?
I don't. I think there are racists in all aspects of our society, and we should root out those racists. But I don't think you can say that the 800,000 people that put on a blue uniform every day and work for a state and local, county, police, or sheriff's department are systemically racist. I think that's not true. I think that there are racists, as I say, across our society, and we should not have them in any place of public responsibility, like in a police department. And in the Justice Act that Tim Scott proposed, Senator of South Carolina, and Pete Stauber, a 25-year police veteran from Minnesota in the House, there were specific ways to decertify officers that have a bad track record, like the murderer of Floyd in Minneapolis. This guy should not have been on the police force. He had a bad track record. People who are bad apples in these police forces, Roby, should be taken out and not be eligible for rehire. We have that in the military. We certainly have it in the private sector. And when you have someone who has a bad record on abusing power, abusing privilege, not de-escalating situations, or personal racist behavior, then they should be not eligible to be in one of our uniformed police forces.
Do you think we can legislate our way out of this problem?
Well, we all have a cultural effort to love our neighbor. We're all created in God's image. We all want equal justice under the law. We all believe in social justice. That's an American tenet enshrined in our governing documents, and I think enshrined in every city council meeting. And our police forces report to quorum courts and city councils, and they should reach out to make sure that they can implement these policies. But in addition to the Justice Act, President Trump put those exact same characteristics in his best practices executive order about how to improve police reform. These are not new ideas. They were in President Obama's 21st Century Policing report that I read during the course of the debates. They're in the Heritage Foundation's Police Department annual survey and annual best practices session that they do. So these are common sense things, but they have to be implemented locally. We control the tone, the style, and the success of our police forces through our local dialogue and through our local elected officials. It's the first point. There are plenty of things the federal government can do. Overall policy, policy of the Justice Department, supporting additional funding, not defunding the police, which is a silly notion. We need more training, more certification, more equipment to make sure that our police can operate in a safe and sound manner and protect themselves and protect the communities they're dedicated to support and swear an oath to support.
Michael, let me ask just one final kind of make sure I'm clarified on this. You think that obviously the feds can set a tone on this, but you say it's got to happen at the local level, because every time we seem to have one of these moments in American history where everybody seems to rally and protest and say this is an injustice, 2 weeks later I'm scratching my head and we are having an exact similar incident happen somewhere else that raises the specter of the issue again.
Well, I've said two things. One, I've said we have things we can do at the federal level, the Department of Justice level, and I've voted for those, and my colleagues have voted for those. And the president, through his executive order, set a good tone on de-escalation, the end of use of chokeholds, the better training, the decertifying bad officers, getting bad cops out of the force, don't let them be eligible for rehire, and other efforts. So we can do that at the federal level. And of course, the federal government at the SAFER Act, both for our first responders in fire and through our money at the federal level, can give body cameras. I support body cameras in all the forces. I've written a lot of letters in my 6 years in the House to support local governments buying body cameras with federal dollars. And they've done that. They protect the police and they protect our citizens. So it's a federal issue, Roby, and people voted for it in the House. Nancy Pelosi didn't finish the job. She didn't produce something that could be signed into law by President Trump. She just went on to the next issue instead of finishing a good, solid effort at police reform. And disappointing. But The second point, and I want to emphasize it, and you know this very, very well, at the fundamental level, those taxes paid and those officers hired and those policies set and that leadership delivered is a local responsibility across thousands of jurisdictions employing 800,000 folks. So it's both is the answer to your question. I just don't want to lose sight that we frequently say that Uncle Sam is going to solve this problem when so many of these things can be solved beautifully, effectively, and locally.
Thank you.
Would you support a major increase in SNAP benefits during this major economic downturn? This is a, you know, obviously a region of the country that is more reliant on SNAP benefits compared to others. There's also the strong pandemic electronic benefit transfer program. Would you support these?
Well, I've already supported them. That was endemic. That was an anchor aspect of the CARES Act, that we expand school nutrition even when school went totally virtual. And I got to thank the Clinton Foundation for stepping up with volunteers and feeding thousands of people using those funds to get food out to our families who no longer got it at school, which so many families are dependent on school nutrition. Our food banks, the CARES Act restocked our food banks dramatically, and people all over America are giving thousands and thousands of dollars of donations to support our food banks. And SNAP, we waived all the requirements on SNAP so that household basic requirements, so that SNAP was more available. So that was an immediate response on a bipartisan basis in Congress and has been taking place and been renewed. And President Trump even released $1 billion additional in September to support these food benefits when Speaker Pelosi would not finally come to concurrence on a consensus legislative package in September. The president took action and gave an extra $1 billion from unallocated CARES Act money to support nutrition during the beginning as school kicked off.
Congressman, you voted in 2017, I believe, for the American Health Care Act. It stalled in the Republican-controlled Senate. The Congressional Budget Office said this would have removed 23 million Americans from health care. That was their analysis. $834 billion in Medicaid cuts. Tell me why that was a better health care plan that would have removed health insurance for 23 million people and taken away more funding for Medicaid?
Well, it changed the formula in Medicaid. I don't believe that number. I know a lot of estimates at the time of the debate of the bill, Roby, that disagreed with that. This actually was something that was being worked on in the Senate as well through Senator Cassidy on how that Medicaid formula would have ultimately turned out if we'd had a consensus bill. Because we were concerned about Medicaid and Medicaid funding and the Medicaid formula for our states. So in my view, it was going to adequately fund Medicaid. So I'll leave that point there. On pre-existing conditions, the bill fully funded pre-existing conditions. It set up a benefit guarantee fund that was paid for, that actuaries at the time of the bill would deliver lower health care for people with pre-existing conditions than the ACA would have, and it would have ended up lowering premiums for everybody with health insurance by the virtue of its design. It was a major improvement over Obamacare, which, as you know, eliminated all the state pre-existing condition pools around the state and made it effectively an unfunded mandate in terms of the way it resulted. And still to this day, almost 30 million Americans don't have health care because of the ACA driving up costs. So there were some ways the ACA expanded access, like Medicaid expansion, but in other instances, it reduced access due to driving up premiums and driving up deductibles, out-of-pocket expenses. And so that's why Republicans in 2017 proposed a market-based approach to essentially replace the failings of the ACA with a different approach. And so in my view, on balance, and the reason I supported it is on balance, it would have provided more access and lower costs for more Americans than we were experiencing under the Affordable Care Act.
Congressman, I'd like to ask your thoughts on the hyperpartisan hostile political environment we're in right now. The presidential debate we saw was not very cordial. You and your opponent, that was a very cordial discussion. But, you know, we've learned about plots to kidnap two governors who had been targeted by President Trump for comments. Do you think the president bears any responsibility for the hostile, almost violent nature now that politics in our country have taken?
Well, Michael, all of us know each other well, and in Arkansas, we try to deal with our disagreements civilly and in a positive fashion, and look for middle ground. And sometimes in our country, rhetoric gets ramped up to a high level. And when you see people rightfully using their First Amendment right to go out and peacefully protest, to call for police reform and racial justice and equal justice under the law, that's something that we all embrace and think is a wonderful American tradition. But when it turns to looting and taking over parts of a city and threatening people with guns and breaking into stores and burning buildings down, and setting the Pharmacy Association building in Little Rock on fire and breaking out windows and trying to steal ATMs, this is ridiculous. This is reckless looting, and we shouldn't support that. And we shouldn't support people who have that as a response to the fact that they disagree politically. Therefore, of course, we all reject someone who would be as crazy as plotting to kidnap, if you believe the press stories, and I guess I do, I haven't really followed it that closely, you know, kidnap a governor? This is insane. And so, Michael, I think all leaders, President Trump, Speaker Pelosi, who's been very, she has not spoken out against this violence. And President Trump could do a much better job in his rhetoric about speaking out against both the left and right people who are using violent acts or threatening violent acts. We need Speaker Pelosi doing that. We need Donald Trump doing that. We need members of Congress doing that. And we talk a lot about solving things civilly. That's something that I've had is my premise of how I've operated in the private sector as a chamber chairman, as a Rotarian, as someone who helped set up and work with Channel 4 on victory over violence in Little Rock. This is something that comes, it's part of my being to do that. And I've done that in the House of Representatives, working in a bipartisan way to accomplish a lot of good things. As I said the other day, I've had bills signed by President Obama, I've had bills signed by President Trump. But look, everyone has a responsibility to reject the tearing down of public statues, destroying public property, destroying private property. And we're in another one of those moments in American history where people have to step up and encourage people to work civilly and not use violence or the threat of violence.
I think we are at the end of our half hour here. Congressman Hill, thank you so much for taking our questions and for visiting with the Delta Grassroots Caucus here. Lee, I'm going to turn it back over to you. Michael, it's been a pleasure co-sharing this conversation with you too. Always good to see you, my friend.
Michael, thank you, and thank Roby, and appreciate your good questions, and appreciate the chance to share a discussion this morning. Thank you, Lee, for your work for our Delta Grassroots effort.
And if there's anything you'd like to add, that we didn't cover, we can give you a couple more minutes or not, but
well, I respect Senator Elliott's need that she had to go on to another event. I just would say thank you to the panel and to you, and for people still thinking about this race and considering leadership in the 2nd Congressional District of Arkansas. I hope people will consider supporting me for re-election to continue my service representing all of the citizens of Central Arkansas. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Congressman Hill.
See you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it.